This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Meredith Farkas. She's a faculty librarian at Portland Community College in Oregon. Her blog, Information Wants to Be Free, can be found at meredith.wolfwater.com. Meredith, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You have been blogging for a very long time, more than a decade. Mm-hmm. One of the things, and we pointed out before we started recording that you were on the show previously, but not with me. You were on with an episode that Kate Sheehan guest hosted. And just to confirm, there was another episode I had with the Annoyed Librarian, and that is not you still, right?
No, I am still not the Annoyed Librarian. Promise.
Yeah, I went back and I was just reading over some other stuff that you had written in the past, and I came across that one again, and I was like, it's funny that you talked about how they were not relevant back then, and then just it's still going on.
I know. I don't know. I don't have quite that level of passive aggressiveness that it would take to sustain a snark blog for that long. Ugh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't look at how long ago that was, but that was many, many years ago. So
it was a really long time ago. I know. I kind of thought it would be like this flash in the pan reflects the annoyance of the sort of library 2.0 time, and then was going to fall away. But no, I mean, I don't read it anymore. But I
know. Somebody linked to it recently, and I was like, oh, that's still around. Okay, I guess so. Okay. But yeah, you are one of the first people I started reading online when I started getting into online stuff, because you've been doing your blog since 2000, what is it, four or five?
Four, yeah.
So what made you want to start blogging?
Probably because I was annoying the heck out of my husband talking about library stuff, because I did my library degree online. I started my blog towards the end of the time I was getting my degree, and there was nobody for me to just, you know, hang out with after class and talk about library stuff, except my poor husband, who really did not. I mean, he's a great listener, but he didn't care that much. So finding a way to sort of get my thoughts out there. Also, I find I'm kind of a slow thinker, and I process my thoughts really well when I'm writing, much better than talking something out. So I just really enjoy it. I kind of find it therapeutic to write and think deeply about how I feel about things in our profession.
And you also have a long-running column in American Libraries magazine. Do you have any kind of thing in your mind of what you decide to write for American Libraries and what you decide to put on your blog? Is there some special mission that you're doing for the column that you wouldn't talk about on your blog or anything like that?
I think they're two very different things. I mean, I feel like my blog is somewhere where I really process my thoughts on things and rant sometimes. And yeah, and my column, I really try to focus on technologies and advice that would be useful for people who are trying to implement technologies at places where maybe they don't have super techie people, they don't have tons of support or money, and how can they sort of make things happen?
Yeah, and one of the posts I was looking at on your blog when I was prepping for this, I seem to recall even reading it back when it first came out. It was from 2014, talking about where I think it was when you had written, it was like your decade look back at the blog.
Oh my gosh.
And you talked about where sort of that rock star phenomenon where you kind of feel like you even feel like maybe you sort of fit into that at one point, but you've moved on past it. And can you talk about that a little bit of that sort of where librarians feel like we have this rock star phenomenon and how you've kind of moved through it?
Yeah. I mean, it was really weird because I started this blog and all of a sudden people were reading it, which was super surprising and very flattering. And, and then, you know, I'm just writing stuff. I didn't even have a job yet. And I get these followers and I get a book deal and all these things just start happening. And for somebody like me who still suffers horribly from imposter syndrome, this is like very disturbing. And I know a lot of people think that's false modesty, but like it getting that much attention is like deeply unsettling and uncomfortable for me. So yeah, it was just really weird to be thought of as a rock star or anything particularly special. Getting the Library Journal Mover and Shaker thing in, God, what was it, 2006 was just weird because I didn't think I'd done enough at that point in my career to even deserve it. You know, I think there are people who try to be rock stars, and those are usually people who are trying to further their career in some way. Either they want to be a consultant or a professional speaker, or they want to get a better job than what they have. So I think there are people who do court that and try to become rock stars. But I think a lot of the people I knew who were thought of as rock stars were just people who were really awesome and wanted to share what they knew with others. And I think of that as being amazingly generous.
That was sort of when you started your blog and there were other people around, that was sort of the period when I was kind of getting started noticing things online too, when I just got out of library school, things like that. So it was you and Jessamine and Sarah Houghton and David Lee King and Michael Stevens and all of, it's sort of, you were the first people who were really blogging and really talking about this stuff. So it wasn't so much that you were trying to be, look how cool I am. It was just, you were the people out there blogging on a regular basis about interesting things.
Yeah. And all of those people you named, I know them and they're wonderful, caring individuals who don't do this because of their ego. They're not out there giving talks and stuff because of that. They are great librarians, and in Michael's case, a great LIS professor. And they, I mean, should be applauded for sharing their ideas with the profession, not hated because they got a lot of attention for that.
Right. I think they were getting attention because, and you, for having great ideas, not just for...
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. Not the Mick Jagger swagger or anything like that.
So. Yeah. And I think, you know, we all had day jobs where we either worked in libraries or worked with library school students. Like, we were, I think, engaged and plugged into what was happening in the real world of librarianship, which is helpful.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of the backlash became, I think, was the people that seemed like they were just professional keynote speakers. And it's like, well, okay, but... Yeah. Are you actually going to put that into practice?
Right. Absolutely. And yeah, I even became uncomfortable with that because often I was talking about stuff that people were doing at other libraries. And I was like, I'm not really talking about what I'm doing at my own library. And I really like how now I give talks much more focused on my own experiences with instruction and assessment and my research, rather than, you know, just finding cool stuff that other libraries are doing and sort of and condensing that and talking about it. I feel much more comfortable, I think, with what I'm doing now.
And do you still do a lot of speaking at conferences, or have you cut back on that?
I cut back a lot. I don't like to travel as much now that I have a child. And also, yeah, I mean, it felt like just so much travel, so much, you know, giving the same talk over and over again. And I really like now that I just give, you know, a few talks a year, I can really make them awesome and really focus on speaking from my own experiences as a community college librarian.
And we won't go into this too much because this is the whole topic of the other episode that you were on of work-life mm-hmm. balance with Kate and Karen and who was fourth person? Jenica. Rogers. But do you feel like you've gotten a good work-life balance at this point? I mean, do you feel like you're is cutting back on the conferences helped balance that for you?
It is always shifting. I mean, every time I feel like I have a good balance, something comes in my work or my life that just sort of screws it up and that I have to reassess. Like, I just had to tell my colleagues at OLA that I'm not going to be the chair of the membership committee next year because I just can't do it anymore because I have to take on another commitment at work and I want to see my family and all that good stuff and have a life. So yeah, it's constantly in flux, and I'm just getting better at saying no to things than I used to be, though still, you know, I think yes people are always yes people, and it can be hard to break oneself of that habit.
Yeah, I think it's hard because, yeah, because we are sort of a profession of people who always want to help and always want to jump in and pitch in. But it's like, yeah, you mm-hmm. have to look out for yourself too. I mean,
yeah,
not to a, you know, narcissistic degree, but there's self-care that you have to take care of too. So.
Oh yeah, totally.
So can you talk about what you do at Portland Community College, what your job is?
Sure. Yeah, I am a faculty librarian here at PCC, and basically that is kind of a generic liaison librarian type role. I teach classes, I work at the reference desk, I do collection development. I have a bizarre array of liaison areas, which I love because they don't, you know, they're not just in the social sciences, which is what I've always done. I've got like performing arts and sign language interpreting and all these really diverse, interesting areas. And yeah, I mean, to me, it's like meat and potatoes librarianship. And that's what I really wanted to get back to after being a manager for about 6 years. I really wanted to start really doing more teaching, less managing of people. And yeah, I love what I do here. It's a great place to work.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's like you're wanting to get more, like, because when you get up into management, you get a level away from people, so you're not so much like, I'm a manager at my job, and so I don't get to mm-hmm. work at the help desk quite as much, and so I don't get to actually interact with the students quite as much and the public or anything like that. So it's nice to get your hands dirty, sort of.
Yeah. I was surprised because I loved being a manager. I loved supporting my direct reports and advocating for them. And I found that work really meaningful. But I remember at one point I got some extra managerial duties, and suddenly I was told, oh yeah, you're not going to be on the desk for a year. And I was like, oh my God, like how do you know what needs to be done or like what's going on and what the zeitgeist is without being at the desk? And so, yeah, I think it's really important to have that contact. And I realize how much I missed it. So, yeah, it's really nice being at a place that is totally focused on student learning and teaching. And it's wonderful.
And you've talked a lot about embedded librarianship. I think mm-hmm. most people who listen to this probably know what that is. But can you kind of talk generally about what embedded librarianship is and how you implement it?
Sure. So embedded librarianship, I think, was originally defined as in terms of being online, like focusing on, you know, having a librarian who is devoted to a specific class, and they are, you know, present in the class through a discussion board or something like that, and they work deeply with the students in that class. And I see that as being a part of embedded librarianship, but to me, it's really about being a critical part of the curriculum, whether that is being deeply involved in certain courses or just making sure that information literacy is embedded in the curriculum, even if a librarian isn't the one teaching it. It's just making sure that that is a critical part of every student's experience.
And is that something that you work at? Do you generally focus that on your subject areas, or do you kind of try to get outside of that as well? Do you work with specific classes or something like that?
Yeah, so we're in an interesting position here at PCC where we are liaisons, but we are at four different campuses. So there are people teaching classes in anthropology, one of my liaison areas at Cascade, that I never get to work with. So I work really closely with departments that are not necessarily my liaison area, like our developmental education program, which includes reading and developmental math. I really try to work closely with them to try to embed information literacy, particularly into Reading 115, which is this major developmental education class that a lot of students take, and they have an actual information literacy project that they have to complete. So making sure we really support them through that is important.
And do you have recommendations for like librarians who are not, maybe their institution doesn't support this kind of thing, how they can sort of arguments they can use to convince their administration maybe that this is something that they should pursue?
Well, I don't even think they need to say, like, we're pursuing embedded librarianship. I think it's, you know, the key thing is really talking to faculty. I think they're mm-hmm. the biggest barrier is, you know, building relationships with faculty. It takes time and effort and being more extroverted than many of us librarians are. I'm an introvert. It is very comfortable for me to stay in my cubicle and do my thing here. But, like, getting out and really getting to know faculty, getting to know what their needs are, what they're seeing with student work that they're frustrated by, and really focusing on meeting those needs and not just focusing on, like, our goals as a library, I think is critical. And when you can show that there are certain needs that are not being met, I think then you can use that as good ammunition with your administrators or whoever to say, like, this needs to happen because our faculty are not happy with what students are doing on this project, and we want to help with that.
Right. So you need to be more proactive and, I mean, show them how the library can help solve a problem that they already have, not just library is great.
Yes, exactly. I mean, yeah, you get those faculty who are like, oh, I love the library. We want to bring the students in to get them to love the library, and there's no assignment or anything tied to it. And you're just like, oh, God, you're going to make the students hate the library. So, yeah, I mean, I love those people who love the library. But, yeah, we really want to make it concrete and focused on, like, how can we help students to be successful? And it's not having them come in with no assignment.
And your previous job was also in Portland. Have you been in Portland for a long time? Did you move there for a job? Are you from the area? Are your husband from that area?
No, I moved there for a job at Portland State University as their head of instructional services. And I was there for, I think, 3.5 years before I came to PCC. So, yeah, I've been here a total of 6 years, and I love, or 5 years, sorry, and I love Portland. It's the best place.
What is it that you like about Portland?
Oh, God, it has everything. It's like, it feels like a small town or a small city, and it is a really small city, but it has everything. We have amazing food culture. We have, you know, this amazing artisan culture where people are making stuff and building stuff and just doing all this great creative work. It just feels very electric living here.
And Portlandia is a good representation or a bad representation?
It's a pretty nice documentary about our town, you know, to a slight extreme. Yeah, but yes, we do have artisan light bulbs and all of that crazy stuff.
And putting birds on things. And
oh, gosh, yes, everywhere. And owls, especially. Owls are like the new black.
So you also teach classes at San Jose.
Yes.
I was going to say MLS program, but I'm not sure what their information school, I guess.
Yes, the I school now.
No library, no term library there. What class or classes do you teach there?
So for a long time, I taught a course on social media, but for the past couple of years, I've been teaching a class focused on embedding libraries into the fabric of higher education. So a lot of what I talked about before, but also, like, working with student support services, reaching out to faculty, even embedding information literacy when we're not actually teaching it, like, teaching faculty how to teach information literacy themselves. So yeah, all of that good stuff. It's a really fun class, and I absolutely love working with library school students. They make me feel so optimistic about the future of our profession.
And how long have you been doing that?
Since 2008. So it's been a while. I wrote, this was another weird thing. I wrote a blog post saying how my dream has always been to teach library school, because I felt like I had such a bad online learning experience in my library school, and I feel like I could do better. And then I got, like, an email a couple of days later from somebody at San Jose State. They are amazing. Like, I cannot recommend working for them more because they are flexible. They really let you try crazy things. I mean, for years I used Drupal as my LMS and just ran it myself and had, you know, used it as a blogging platform and a course management platform. And it was really, really fun. And they just, yeah, they support whatever it is you want to do with your class.
And it seems like they're one of the better schools that are keeping up with the changing profession, because sometimes I always use the example. I mean, I went to school more than 10 years ago now, but they were still teaching, you know, command line dialogue and stuff. And it's like, what are you doing here? But I mean, a lot of library schools tend to sometimes be a little behind what's actually happening in libraries. But I've always heard that San Jose is pretty good at that.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. They're always on the cutting edge. I mean, sometimes to the point where I'm like, wow, that's a really specific class. Like, oh my God, like what is Web 3.0? I don't even know what that means. But like they are definitely, they have their finger on the pulse of like what employers are looking for. I think it's great that they're in Silicon Valley, that the person in charge of the program has a background working in the corporate area of librarianship. And I think they bring that understanding that, you know, many people will be working in libraries, but others won't. And we need to build that also non-traditional skill set so that we can be a flexible profession.
Well, you, we talked earlier about the when you started your blog and everything, and mm-hmm. the book that you wrote, Social Software and Libraries, you were talking about social media pretty early on in social media. Do you still keep active in social media?
I keep active personally on social media, and I do help maintain our library's Facebook page, which this is the first time I've ever actually been in charge of a library Facebook page, which is very ironic since I've talked about this stuff forever. I definitely never sort of fetishized social media. I always felt like it's a tool, and if it has a good use in your professional work, great. But yeah, we have a Facebook. I convinced my colleagues to get rid of our Twitter account because we weren't updating it often enough, and it seemed to make more sense to focus on a single point of contact that more of our students were using. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I use social media a lot personally. I'm not on Twitter as much as many people because I just can't. I'm not good at juggling like my my work and the stream.
Jumping in and out of the river.
Oh God, I don't know how people do it. I'm always so impressed. Like my research partner on a lot of projects, Lisa Hinchliff, who's running for ALA president. She like is always super engaged on Twitter and stuff, even before she was running for ALA president, and yet she's super productive in every other aspect of her life. I kind of think has a clone somewhere who's doing some of this, but you know.
That's a scandal we're breaking out for the election season.
Yes, Lisa Hinchliffe, clone. Yeah, it's like Orphan Black.
but I think you're right that, like you said, you've cut back just the Facebook page because it is just a tool and you want to use the right tool, not just jump in and say, oh, well, we have a Facebook and an Instagram and a Twitter and a blah, 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 everything. I was like, well, but just use what your people are actually using. So,
well, and also like, how much return on investment are you getting from this?
Right.
You know, like we don't have a ton of followers. I know some libraries have a ton of followers. They get a lot of interaction. We don't. I think we primarily are using it as a like sending out news and lighthearted, cute stuff and informational things about using the library. But like, how much time do you want to devote to something that might not be as important to your library as like your instruction program or other things? You had to weigh it.
And that could go away at any moment too. I mean, I remember, you know, 10 years ago, everybody was like, we got to be on MySpace. We got to be on MySpace. And like, well, okay.
Yeah. Friendster.
Somebody the other day mentioned the, Second Life, and I was like, I guess ALA Island is still around somewhere, and it's it's like the, I imagine it's like the world at the end of Inception, where that there's just like this, nobody goes to it anymore. All the buildings are falling apart, and it's just.
Yeah, I was always so skeptical of Second Life, and I tried to, you know, because I had some friends who were like super enthusiastic and worked there and everything, but I thought, is this really the future of reference services? I don't think that's what a lot of people were coming to Second Life for. It just, yeah, I was really skeptical, and I've been skeptical of other things and been completely wrong about them in the past. So, but that was one I'm like, yeah, okay, tick that off. I was right.
Well, you also wrote one piece about the Librarian of Congress, and I know one thing that was, you said they changed your title, so it actually didn't sound like you said, they said, I guess, the next Librarian of Congress should be an actual librarian, and you didn't actually say that or make that case at all. But no. Now that there's been at least a nomination of somebody, are you happy with the nomination of Carla Hayden?
Beyond my wildest dreams. I mean, I didn't think Obama would be that forward thinking to nominate somebody who not only is a librarian, but has this amazing background in supporting user rights, both with copyright and privacy. That is amazingly exciting to me. And the fact that he did that, given his kind of lackluster history with protecting the privacy of his citizens. I don't know, like it's a really weird mixed message, but like kind of making me very happy and excited.
Yeah, we can knock on wood that she actually is confirmed. So that hasn't gone through the whole process yet, and who knows.
Well, and I know, and they're trying to take the Copyright Office away from the Librarian of Congress altogether, which it's like, finally, we'll have somebody decent and they won't have any authority. Great.
Yeah, it was funny to read the responses from the MPAA and the RIAA of just the sort of, oh yeah, we're happy, sure.
As long as she leaves us, as long as she leaves us alone, as they have.
And like you said, you didn't put that part in there, but there was some arguing of the, oh, you know, he chose an actual librarian, but to me, I think I even use that phrase, but I don't mean somebody that, you know, that has an MLS. I mean somebody that, you know, we'll take our values and bring it into that sphere. Unlike the former Librarian of Congress, who's a historian, things like that, that they have their own values, and it's not really the same as what librarians value, I think.
Oh, totally. Totally. I think there are tons of people out there who would have supported the values that we hold dear about libraries, and also would come with that background of really deeply understanding where technology is going in terms of preserving and making accessible cultural heritage materials. And there are lots of people who get that who don't have a degree in library science. But gosh, I mean, to have somebody like her who has that too and has run large, confusing, complex organizations and, you know, doesn't communicate by fax and throw things at people and abuse their employees. At least I've never heard of her doing any of those things. That sounds truly wonderful.
Yes. No, I'm very hopeful that she'll get the nomination. So.
Yeah, me too.
Another thing that you had written about in the past, and I had talked about a little bit on some social media stuff that it happened because I hadn't. So you have an article in every issue of American Libraries. You have your column, and I had an article in the January issue. And in that same issue, there was another article that people had some problems with, because including the authors of the article.
Yes.
Because apparently, I don't know that we still have the entire story of what happened, but they wrote this article, and then American Libraries, somebody inserted some quotes from a vendor that made it sound like it would come, like you would assume that the authors put it in there.
Right.
Have you ever had an issue, not even specifically American Libraries, but with anybody you've written for before, having this sort of, I guess, problematic editing is a good term for it, of putting things in that you didn't, that changed the message of what you were putting in?
I have never had an experience like that, and I would be just as livid as those authors had I had an experience like that. I know with my book, a copy editor went through it and, like, I thought completely changed my way of writing in a way that it didn't read like me at all anymore. And I actually went through and, like, rechanged tons of it because it just felt like they were changing it for change's sake, not because there was anything actually wrong. Like, they couldn't identify that there was anything actually wrong with the way I wrote it. So I've always pushed back on that. But yeah, right. I was really appalled that happened, especially at American Libraries, where I've had such positive experiences with my editors, and they've, you know, always show me the changes they make, and I approve them or make additional changes or push back. But they've always been very, very good and helpful with me. But yeah, I feel like what kind of drove me crazy about that whole thing was, like, it's like every other social media backlash. Like, everybody freaks out about it and yells, and there's an apology, and people don't take it seriously, and that just disappears.
Yep.
Like, I don't feel like anything's been really substantially addressed about it.
That's what I, well, when I put the topic down here to kind of bring up with you and talk to you, I was like, I don't even know how that ended. It was just sort of everybody got mad, and then, like you said, there was the sort of apology, but semi-apology, and then that was kind of it. And I think they got permission, I guess, then to publish it elsewhere without those quotes in it.
Yeah, no, I know. Like, this is why social media drives me crazy these days. It's like, we have this, like, blame and shame game, and we all, like, get this vitriol out. Oh, we're so angry. But then we just go on to the next thing to be angry about instead of actually trying to change the thing that we were focused on in the first place. And I feel very strongly that American Libraries needs to address this head on and look at their editorial guidelines so that they never do this again to an author. Because I mean, I remember Lisa Hinchliffe brought up, rightly so, how do we know, how can we trust that your stuff hasn't been edited like this?
Right.
And that is a cause for concern. I mean, I've never had that experience. And I know Joe Jane said the same thing on Twitter. Like, we've all had really good experiences. But how is anybody supposed to trust that what we wrote is what we wrote?
Right. Like the article that I had written was about podcasts. Like, how does somebody not know that Apple paid me not to put in a sentence about their podcasting apps?
Right.
Or maybe they gave American Libraries money to put that in. Or you mentioned some library vendor, and it's like, well, did you actually say that? Or did they pay you to say that? Or
right, exactly.
It's the appearance of impropriety.
I know. I really feel like this needs to be addressed more deeply than it has. And I hope that something's going on with they have an advisory committee, and then there's, like, publications committees. I hope somebody is doing something right now to address this beyond just an apology.
And it would be nice if there was sort of transparency to know that if that was happening, because as far as we know, maybe that is happening, and we just, you know, sometimes things in an organization as large as ALA, things move at a glacial pace sometimes as getting things done. Maybe they're waiting, oh, well, you know, when we can meet at annual, you know, we'll talk about that. And so,
yeah. Well, and also I completely get why one wouldn't want to be transparent after the kind of backlash they got.
Right.
Like, I would want to sweep this under the rug if I had been subject to that kind of vitriol and a complete lack of, like, productive dialogue.
Well, and again, that's another problem with that outrage culture sort of thing of,
yeah,
why would they want to engage you if that's how you're going to respond?
Yeah. Oh, my God. I read that John Ronson book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, this summer. And I was it's like everything that makes me crazy about social media. And I've become so much more aware of this, like, cycle of vitriol and just trying not to let myself get pulled into it to be irrational with everyone else.
Yeah, well, and, you know, and we're not going to get into a political discussion, but, you know, but that feeds into larger issues of the other things that people that are popular because of outrage and things like that. And it's just, it's sort of the overall culture is sort of getting like that. And I think Twitter and Facebook just sort of make it easier because you can just sit at your keyboard and type something out and it's not looking somebody in the eye.
Exactly. And we vented our outrage about this issue and now we don't actually have to do anything substantial to right. make the world a better place.
Yeah. So that's a problem.
Yeah. My views on social media have definitely changed over the years, but sorry.
Well, and related to that, I mean, librarians often have, I guess problematic is a good word for it, relationships with vendors that sometimes we're a little too cushy with them. I mean, I know I'm going to PLA soon. I'm getting all these invitations to parties and all this kind of stuff. It's like, well, should I be going to a big fancy schmancy party put on by a vendor when I'm supposed to be learning? I mean, that's always a problem too.
Yeah. I've gotten, you know, it always feels nice. Like, oh, I'm invited to all these cool events and I'm going to be with the cool kids. But like, yeah, it's deeply problematic to be taking all these like perks from these companies when they're giving us such garbage to deal with so much of the time, you know, and spending like, you know, Ex Libris spends all this great money on making us love them or whatever, or not hate them. But then like, once you have their product, like we have Alma and Primo, actually getting them to change substantially things that we're deeply unhappy with is almost impossible. And we're a giant consortium out here. We're like most of the academic libraries in the Pacific Northwest, and we still can't get what we want.
Yeah, but here's a tote bag though. So
yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I know. I remember when Google got rid of their like librarian blog. People were like, oh, they don't love librarians anymore. Blah blah blah. I'm like, they never loved us. I mean, they're using us, don't you?
Yeah, because I remember they came to like ALA conferences for a few years there and had big huge booths and then they went away. And it's like,
I don't want to like a vendor because they're kissing my butt. Like, that's so ridiculous.
Right.
It's so ridiculous. This is why I mostly stay out of the exhibit halls. I don't go to events like that. I don't accept things from vendors because I just feel way too uncomfortable with that.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the problem is that, like you said, I mean, it puts us at a disadvantage because we're already apparently a pretty much of a pushover, I guess, with vendors because they just kind of do whatever they want with us and we just kind of accept it.
Well, because the cost of leaving is so high. I mean,
right, that's the thing with journals. Like, you have a college that has a huge biology program. You can't just say, well, we're not going to have Nature anymore. It's like, well, you can't just not have one of the premier journals.
Exactly. So, and our faculty pressure us and put us in a position where we can't take a political stance. And I admire people like Jenica, who took that stance with the American Chemical Society and other people who've really like libraries that have put their foot down and said, we're not going to take your horrible package deals that keep going up exponentially every year. Like, we're not doing this.
And that kind of thing, I think, requires, and I think Jenica got that, it requires faculty backup. I mean, you have to have their buy-in, so.
Oh, yeah. I mean, otherwise, you're going to lose any support for your library. So, yeah, you need to sort of advocate with faculty and, you know, sort of get them politicized and angry about these things, too.
As libraries are obviously changing a lot, and outside people, you know, have the always libraries are dead, blah 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 blah, and we know they're not. We're just changing, and people don't understand what we're changing into. Do you have any thoughts on how we can help manage that change with our communities and within ourselves? Because I think we also have a lot of staff, a lot of times that have been around for a long time, and they don't quite understand how to change either.
Right. Well, I think this is why assessment is so amazingly valuable, because instead of making the case like we have to change because the profession's changing and the world's changing, we can actually collect user experience data and other sorts of user needs assessment data and show like this is what our users need and want. This is what we're seeing in our communities. We're getting out there and talking to people. And we need to change because of this, not just because of our intuition about how things are changing or because we really fetishize whatever cool thing we're reading about in whatever magazine or wherever. You know, it really needs to be about the users and what they need and want from us and how our communities are changing and how we can be there. And I mean, that's why it's always nice to see different libraries doing different things and not being in lockstep. I mean, for some libraries, makerspaces are the way to go. You know, others are circulating. Like I just saw that the Hillsborough Public Library in my area is circulating karaoke machines. And I'm just like, that is awesome. That's the cool. Like just go where, you know, do what your users need and want from you. You know, try innovative things, you know, that aren't super expensive or whatever. Give them a try and see if they stick. But like, really, our focus should be on assessing and basing what we do on that and not the things that we're super duper excited about.
Well, and that ties into what you were talking about when we were talking about embedded librarianship. I mean, that's what you're doing there. You're getting with your faculty and with your students and figuring out what that is they actually need.
Yeah.
And not just pushing what you think is cool because you read about it. Some other library did it. So.
And God, I've had those moments. I mean, I did an embedded librarian pilot in my first job where I was embedded in all of these online classes and like thought, oh, I'm doing what they did at Vermont Technical College and it's so cool and this is just what I wanted to do. I read this great article and I'm going to make it happen. And it was like a disaster. Basically, all of the reference questions that we normally got through the desk, through our entire reference team, were coming to me. And it was so much work. They expected me to be on 24/7, and it was just unsustainable. It was completely unsustainable. So yeah, we've all had those moments where like, that sounds so cool, I'm going to try it here, and it's a disaster. And you know, our students really didn't need me to be more accessible in that way.
Right.
You know, I learned that putting content in their classroom proactively was really helpful, but being like in 27 different discussion boards that I had to check every single day multiple times was not an efficient use of my time and didn't really help students that much.
Well, and that's something I think, I don't remember if it was you that I was reading or somebody else, but like when you're sort of, especially when you're fresh out of library school, you're all of these full of ideas and you want to just implement all these new things and change everything. But it's also important sometimes, I think, to understand, get to know a place first before you come in and just sweep in all these changes, because it could be just something that they're doing for a long time is good because it's a good thing, not just, I mean, sometimes it's the, well, that's what we've always done, so that's how we do it. But figure out what is the right thing to do, not just, I'm new, and I'm going to do new things.
Yeah, and I don't even think it's just new librarians who do that. I remember having a colleague who had been at this one other library for like 20-something years, and then came in, just wanted to like make our library just this mini version of their previous institution. And we're going to, oh, well, this is how we did it here. And it's like, oh, we're not the same. We have a different population. Like, let's figure out what they need.
Yeah, I try not to do that as much as I can. I've been in the same library system for a while, but I've moved to different branches. And I try not to just do everything we did at the last branch, because each community is different. So.
Oh, totally.
Well, Mark, Meredith, where can people go to find out more about you online?
Well, they can go to my blog, Information Wants to Be Free, which is at meredith.wolfwater, all one word, .com. That's a good place to sort of see what I'm up to. I don't blog quite as much as I used to, but I do my best.
Yeah, I did. I talked to the author, Cory Doctorow, mm-hmm. a while back, and he mentioned that he doesn't like the Information Wants to Be Free thing anymore, because he says information doesn't want to be anthropomorphized. But
I love that.
But
yeah,
it's cute.
Yeah.
All right, Meredith, thank you so much for talking to me.
Oh, certainly, it was really fun. Thanks, Steve.
All right, thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta. Music is by Pamela Klicka. If you'd like to learn more about the show, listen to past episodes, or read transcripts, visit circulatingideas.com. You can follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas, like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas, or drop me an email at mail@circulatingideas.com. If you'd like to support the show, visit patreon.com/circideas. And please rate, review, and recommend the show on iTunes, Overcast, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice to help others find the show. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas. Yeah, this would be very interesting if I couldn't hear you the whole time.
Oh, that was a very interesting answer, Meredith.
Just randomly say that. And
yeah. So you. And how do you feel about that?
Just talk for about 45 minutes, and then I'll just interrupt. Every once in a while, interrupt you. So.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, libraries, huh? Yeah. Mm-hmm.